Welcome to this first seminar, seminar on being beyond hope. Could God use me? Would God choose me? I am a vicar. I lead a church down in Devon. Wow, I didn't think people came from the Southwest anymore. Now we've moved Soul Survivors so far away from civilization. I run a church which is all about trying to reach unchurched youth, the guys that have no interest in church, trying to make church relevant for them. And before that, I used to be a vicar out in some villages out in near Exeter. I don't know about you, why you're here, you know, whether you just stumbled into this venue, whether your friends were coming, whether you fancied somebody who was coming, or whether actually this is an issue you really grapple with. It could be on the big scale of feeling so useless and life such a mess, or it could be on the small scale. I've just had a sabbatical, which means 3 months holiday. I mean 3 months break to study and reflect and grow in my faith as a vicar, having been ordained for long enough. And I've been studying during those 3 months, if my bishop asks, and I've been studying about losers in the Bible. Going through the Bible and looking at all the people that really screw it up or are just really not very nice, and yet God loves them and chooses them. And that's someone that's some fairly major scale failure, and we'll look at some of that later. But then after the end of my 3 months to end my sabbatical, I went on holiday with my family for 10 days to Italy. We have been by the pool, 40 degree heat, kind of having the ideal family holiday, loving each other, building each other up, thinking wonderful thoughts about each other most of the time. But I don't know, I don't think it's the big stuff that knocks me down. It's just the little digs and attacks from my family that sometimes make me feel more useless than anything else. You know, it's the moments when you think you're a competent father who can organize stuff and navigate your family through Rome, and your 15-year-old just in the end gets so frustrated with you, he takes over and goes, look, this is how to read a map, Dad. Look, it's just going to be a much more pleasant time if you don't get involved at all in where we're going. Follow me. And the really gutting thing is he's right. Or it's when you've lovingly, as a kind of, you're trying to be the provider, carer, competent father, you've booked the tickets for everything, you've booked the plane, you've organized yourself enough that 24 hours before you've gone on that online check-in to check in, you've gone, there are four of us in the family, I've remembered how many are in the family, and there are three in a row on the plane, so how do you put four people in a row of three? I know what we'll do three in a row, and then one, the other side of the aisle, they can chat over the aisle, it'll be lovely. You tell your wife and she goes, why would you book it like that? Why would you make it that we all sit together and you sit on your own and ignore us? I didn't say that was how it's going to work. I was hoping that was how it's going to work. So she said, why didn't you do it like two by a window so we can see Paris as we fly over, so we can enjoy the wonders of flight? Your children will love it on one side and then two on the other side. And I went, darling, you're a genius. You should have booked the flights. Let's do that. So it was too late to do it on the way out. And then in Rome, I was competent enough to 24 hours before we flew back to go online and check in and choose the seats for us. And I don't know what happened to me, but in my brain, I thought, wouldn't it be lovely if we had two each side of the aisle? Then you'd have to get out to get to the toilet. You'd have to fight over people. We can chat over the aisle. This will be the perfect scenario. So I did that. I thought, shall I check with our 13-year-old whether I'm making good life choices? No, I'm a competent man. So I booked it and then went to my family and went, I've done the online check-in, I've sorted the seats how we wanted them. And they all went, no, we didn't. Do you never listen to a word we say? Are you completely stupid? They didn't say it quite. Yeah, they did. Now, that to you, you're like, who cares where you sit on the plane? Who cares why you book it in? Who cares the fact you don't listen to your family? For me, it's the little failures that actually niggle away at me sometimes and make me think, how stupid am I? And sometimes it's the big stuff. And I don't know where you are on that spectrum, whether you just little things in your day can crush you, or whether actually just your whole life feels a mess, or whether actually you feel great and you're really wondering why you came to this seminar. I said I used to work in a village church. There was a village church once. You know, just picture, I don't know what kind of church you go to, but you can probably imagine the church where you walk in, the kind of proper Church of England church, with that slightly damp smell of must and rotting people. And the books, you open them and kind of, you know, the moths fly out. There was a church like that once, and there was a guy, he didn't really do church. He may have done it in his childhood, but he just found himself in church. One Sunday morning, his life basically had fallen apart. He was really successful, great marriage, great business and everything else, and he made some bad choices. And the business began to sink. And he buried his head in the sand and didn't deal with the fact the business was going wrong, and it got worse and worse to the point he was bankrupt. He didn't really tell his wife what was going wrong. He began to drink. He got a bit into drugs and other stuff. And a little while later, the marriage fell apart. And this bloke had lost everything. He had messed up. He had failed. He had failed his family. He'd messed up in all sorts of ways. And this bloke, John, one Sunday found himself in this old church, sat there, just going, I don't know what to do. The service went on, kind of drifted over his head, and it came to communion. And at the same time as John was sat there, kind of head in hands, wondering what to do, there's a little girl, Ellie. Ellie was three, and she was from a family which was a bit of a mess. They weren't great at caring for her. You know, she was the kind of kid that would run around church and mess about and be disruptive, and all the older people would frown and roll their eyes and try and find the parents and tut. In that kind of helpful Christian way of communicating, you know, failure and poor parenting. And it came to communion, and everybody, as you do in a Church of England church, we do it properly. You line up in a neat, orderly line, and everybody waits their turn, and it's very respectful. And as everybody's queuing nicely to go forward for communion, little Ellie's kind of bombing between the legs, you know, almost knocking grannies over in their Zimmer frames. And Ellie gets to the front of the communion queue, and then does the completely unacceptable thing. She ducks the communion rail and goes into the holy place. We don't really believe it's the holy place, you know, holy place, but it's the place you don't go. And Ellie ducks through. By the time Ellie's got under the communion rail, John has actually come forward for communion. And John is kneeling at the rail on the left-hand side. And nobody really knows John. They don't know what's going on in his head. Ellie ducks under the communion rail, kind of beetles past all the little people queuing for communion, and Ellie goes over and kisses John on the forehead. And like a little three-year-old, just scampers away. And at that moment, John completely breaks. He collapses his sobbing, snotty wreck. And nobody knows until later that John, whose life has fallen apart, is at the communion rail, crying out to God, going, if there's hope, if you care about me at all, if there's any point to my life moving forwards, I need to know some physical sense of your love for me. I need you to physically show me you love me. And little Ellie is the one that does it. Now you might think, as a three-year-old, there's no hope. She doesn't know God. She doesn't hear God. How could God use her? Or you might think for John that God's not bothered. He's screwed his own life up. He's made bad choices. But that story, and I may have got some of the details wrong, but that is a true story, shows that we're not beyond hope. We've done loads of pastoral training in our church and in previous places I've worked. And I love role plays. I think I'm just like people and their stories, and I love kind of conjuring up. And role plays in some of the things like safeguarding training, that you have little strips of paper and you have a little scenario of a person, and you have to put them into order or work out how would we help them with that. You know, the kind of things like the lad who has been at family events, and you know where family events, the kids are sent off to play, whether they get on or not, the cousins. And that lad is made to go and play cards with the cousins, and the parents have a lovely time because the kids are gone, they can relax and enjoy themselves. And what they don't know is the lad is being shut in a freezer by his cousins in the big chest freezer out back. And when he tries to tell the parents, nobody believes him or cares. You know, that scenario. The scenario of the girl who has been self-harming and not told anybody and is becoming more of an issue on a daily basis. The girl who's in her late teens, who she doesn't really know how it began, but it feels like what happened was one night she couldn't really sleep, parents were in bed, and she went downstairs and she was bored and she just thought she'd flick on the telly and see what was on, and she was cruising the channels and she saw something she'd never seen before. She saw kind of sexual acts and stuff and people, and she was kind of grossed out by it, but actually intrigued, and she carried on watching. And then the next night she couldn't sleep and she went back down and she found herself becoming addicted to watching that kind of stuff in the middle of the night. The girl who was in a relationship and the bloke was coming on a bit strong and well, she loved him and she wanted to know that he loved her and they ended up having sex and she's not sure how it happened, but she didn't really want it to happen. And other scenarios. Yeah, on these little strips of paper, these scenarios of different situations. The girl who went to a party and coming back late at night. Some bloke approached her in the street. The woman who very prim and proper from a family where they never really talked about relationships and stuff, ended up having a relationship with a guy. And she's now in her 30s, but she had a relationship with a guy one night and she got pregnant. And she had an abortion. And all people at church see her as this incredibly kind of straight-laced person who never talks to guys. And she helps with the children's work. And what they don't know for that woman is that she helps with the children's work because in her mind, as she talks to the 11-year-old girl, that's the age her baby would have been if she hadn't had the abortion. And she pictures the 11-year-old in front of her playing with whatever stuff and that. And in her mind, she's seeing her little girl in heaven in a room doing the same kind of stuff. We do those kind of scenarios in training. I often wonder, wouldn't it be great, or wouldn't it be wrong, but to my mind helpful, if at one point we turned around and said, okay guys, are you lot in the church, you lot who look so sorted, you lot who don't seem to have any problems, why didn't you go and pick up the piece of paper that relates to you? Because in my church, we're a small church, we're a great church, we're full of incredibly beautiful, lovely people who all look at each other and they go, well, everybody else is sorted, I'm a mess, I have this stuff that I carry, these stories, this stuff that's gone wrong in my life, and everybody else doesn't have that stuff, and I can't tell them because they wouldn't understand, or I'm useless and I'm beyond hope because they're all so sorted, and I kind of want to go, actually, guys, if we picked up the pieces of paper, everyone in this room would have one that fits them. I want to go kind of in a group session. You know, guys, put your hands up if this has happened to you. But that wouldn't be helpful because I don't want to expose people. But I'd love us to realize most of us look at everyone around us and go, they're okay. But if they knew about me, they'd reject me or they wouldn't believe it. And the Bible is full of people who are a mess. I love the story of Noah, partly because it's one of the best ones at Sunday school. Yeah, I love the story of Noah because the animals go in two by two and the archy-archy. You're all too young to know the song. And the story of Noah, the amazing man of faith who builds an ark when there's no rain in the desert and he does all that. And that's the end of the story when he comes off the ark and the lovely... But that's not the end of the story because the end of the story of Noah is then in his retirement, he plants a vineyard and he discovers that grapes are better later in life. Grapes are better when they've rotted and fermented and become this amazing red liquid that you can drink called wine, which most of you are too young to know about. And Noah starts drinking this wine to the point where he is so completely wasted. Somehow he can't quite work it out, but he's lost all his clothes and he's lying naked in his tent with everything exposed to the world. This is Noah, the kind of worship leader, kind of, you know, great Christian leader, completely stark as in the middle of Soul Survivor. And his kids, one of them spots it and goes, hey, look at dad, because that's what kids do to their dads. Look at him, he's such a loser. And the other two go, no way. And they do this weird thing where they pick up a coat and they're too embarrassed and don't want to see dad's bits. They pick up a coat and they kind of carry it between them and they reverse over dad and they drop the coat to cover up. Now I'm like, God, that is harsh. Noah, for 800 years, ridiculously, does a brilliant job. In his last 10 minutes, he screws it up and embarrasses himself and gets drunk. Who knew? How did Noah know wine got you drunk? You know, it's not on the label in those days, whatever percent alcohol. And yet, God, you humiliate him by putting in the Bible that he messed up. But I think God puts it in there because he goes, even the best of people, we can screw it up. I don't know how much you know about your history of the Old Testament, and we might do a little test in a minute. How many kingdoms were there in the Old Testament, in the people of God, in the promised land when they moved in, the kind of Jerusalem area. There was a northern kingdom and southern kingdom. I was going to make that easy for you. And what were they called? The northern kingdom and southern kingdom. This is knowledge. Go on.
Samaria and Judea.
Samaria is part of one of them. There's up north. This is a test. I am looking. There are theology students in the room who I'm looking at, waiting for them to put their hands up. Up north, you have the kingdom of Israel. And down south, you have the kingdom of Judah. Now, you don't need to know that. I'm just telling you that. But there are those two kingdoms. Now, the kingdom of Israel is named after a bloke. It's a bloke who's called Jacob. And Jacob is a bit of a loser. Jacob is a man who basically, from before he's born, is a trickster and a con artist and a swindler. When he's born, he's one of twins. His brother Esau comes out of the womb first. Jacob is so desperately fighting his brother to be there first. He's holding onto his brother's heel, trying to pull him back into the womb. Possibly not consciously, because they're babies. But literally, he comes out grabbing his brother's heel, and he's there trying to take his brother's place. They call him Jacob because of it. Not a great name, you know, like con artist is not the best name for your parents to give you. Swindler. Jacob comes out of the womb fighting, and that is the story of their whole childhood. You can read about it in the Bible. And Jacob manages to con his brother out of his birthright. Brother's the firstborn child. That means you get all the inheritance. Firstborn kids are favorites in those days. It's changed over history. I'm a second child. It's not true anymore. Firstborn gets all the inheritance, all the money, all the wealth, all the success and everything. But one day, Esau comes back from killing things, hunting. He's knackered, he's tired, he's hungry. His brother's at home with mum cooking. Esau walks in and goes, "That smells amazing, give it to me." And Jacob goes, "What's it worth?" And Esau goes, "I don't know, I'm hungry, I can't think. I can't think without food." Some of you teenage lads will recognize this. And Jacob goes, "I tell you what, sell me your birthright and I'll have all the inheritance and the firstborn stuff and you can have a stew." And Esau goes, "I'm so hungry I could die. If I die, my birthright's worth nothing. I'll have the stew." So he gives away his inheritance to his brother over a bowl of stew. Some of you lads have done probably similar things. And Jacob carries on in that way. He spends all his life tricking him, and it gets worse later. He goes into the dressing up box and puts on kind of hairy clothes because his brother's hairy. His brother was called Hairy. They weren't particularly imaginative parents. And he manages later to con his dad to give a blessing and things. It goes on in life that Jacob's a bit of a con artist. There's nothing kind of particularly attractive about him. And then one day God meets him. He doesn't deserve God to meet him. Well, God meeting him, God could have said, "Right, let's have a chat, young man. Jacob, you've been a very naughty boy. I'm disappointed in you. I don't really think much of you. You have failed in your faith. Basically, mate, sort yourself out." But God doesn't. God wrestles with him. God comes close to him. God holds him. And in the end, at the end of that, a night of fighting with God, of wrestling through stuff, God says, "What's your name?" And Jacob has to say, "Who I am is somebody who cheats and lies." And God says, "No more. I'm going to give you the name Israel. And that people, Israel, is going to be my chosen people. The people whom I love in the world. The people who I will die for." And I'm like, Jacob doesn't deserve that. But that's who God makes him. The other bit, Judah. Judah, Jesus is called the Lion of Judah. Judah, we know very little about. He's one of Joseph's brothers. He's one of Jacob's sons. And you may have seen a musical about it, or you may know songs about it. But Jacob's one. All we really know about Jacob is this some nice qualities. He decides that killing Joseph's a little bit extreme. That's good life advice. Killing siblings is a bit extreme. Let's just sell him instead. That's not good life advice. Selling your brothers and sisters is not okay. And also, he's a little bit protective when Benjamin later with grain and stuff. The only other thing we know about Jacob in the entire Bible is he gets married. We don't know what his wife's called. And he has three sons. He's not good at naming his kids either. He calls one of them Ur. What's your name? Ur. One of them Onan. And the other one's Shelah. They're boys. And Ur marries a girl called Tamar. And Ur drops dead when they end up married together. I think, you know, kind of they have sex and he dies. The Bible's not too explicit. And it says Ur dies because he's been such a bad boy, God kills him. Slightly harsh. So the way it worked in those days, this is if you're too young to worry about it, but what it used to be is if you were the eldest brother and you married a girl and you die, your next brother then has to step into your place and marry the girl. So younger brothers, you know, make sure your older brother marries a nice girl, because if he dies, you're in next. And the idea was that then you would marry the wife, you would marry the widow, and you would produce your firstborn child, and they would be as if the child of your dead brother. And this stuff we don't quite understand culturally, really, isn't there? So he marries Onan, number two, marries Tamar. And we don't need to go into the precise details, but Onan is a little bit scared of making babies and having sex with Tamar because he's seen what's happened to his brother. So he doesn't really quite go through with the act. And he drops down dead. Because he's a bad boy too. Because he's dishonored his brother. And at this point, Jacob goes, this girl's not good for my boys. Basically, I marry them to her and then they die. He doesn't think, actually, looking at my kids and the way they behave, it probably is their problem, not Tamar's. So Jacob, this amazing man of God, he decides that the best thing to do would be to hide Sheila, pretend he's a girl, and not give him to Tamar. And so he says to Tamar, stay here. Yeah, when Sheila's old enough, you can marry Sheila. But he has no plan to do it. And in those days, that would have meant that Tamar was destitute. She had no income. She had no security. She had nothing. So then the weirdest thing in the Bible, no, actually nowhere near the weirdest thing in the Bible. Tamar takes stuff into her own hands and she dresses kind of like a prostitute. And sits by the city gate. Judah, this man of God, is on his way to a city and walks past and goes, hello, how about it? And she says, okay, if you give me your cloak, your seal, your staff, your three kind of greatest marks of who you are, yes, they have sex, this man of God. He doesn't tell anybody, he keeps it secret and shameful, and he goes off and he says he'll come back later and he'll pay her and get his gear back. He goes back later to pay her and there's no prostitute at that city gate. There's no knowledge of her. She's never been there. And he goes, probably better just to forget about it and not make a fuss because it would look really bad for me if I admitted to what I've done. A few months later, he spots that Tamar's getting bigger. And she doesn't fit into her grieving clothes anymore. And she's pregnant. And Judah goes, you terrible, disgusting girl. You shameful girl. You shall be stoned because you have prostituted yourself. You are immoral. You are useless. You are a failure. I don't want anything to do with you. And Tamar goes, hang on a second. The bloke that got me pregnant is the owner of this seal. Do you recognize it? This coat's his. This staff's his. And all of a sudden, Judah goes, oh my goodness, you're not the one that's wrong. I am. Now, why do I tell you that? Some of you are like, yeah, why did you tell us that? Because that bloke who's done nothing good, that bloke who there's nothing good about, I can see other than he occasionally looks after his brothers, is the man whose name God says, you will be the name of my people, of half my kingdom, the Lion of Judah. I will name my people after you. Now, I don't think God goes to church enough. Because that is not how church works. You don't go, let's take the person who's most shameful, who's done the worst stuff, who's completely denied God, who's slept around, who's slept with prostitutes, who's lied about it, who's cheated, and go, hey, let's call him the name of our church. But that's what God is like. It doesn't make sense. It offends us. And as you are here going, but I'm a mess and I'm out of God's kind of plans and I've messed up and gone wrong. Don't, because God goes, I could choose you. I do choose you. We do a great thing in Exeter. It's one of my favorite things where we go into schools And we do, it's part of PSHE. I don't know what your views of PSHE are. I never had any PSHE. I had a Christian biology teacher who used to have a migraine on a Monday double biology lesson, so he didn't have to talk to us about sex. So we never learned anything, because he was like a Christian, and we couldn't possibly talk about sex, although it was his job. We go in and we do various things, and one of my favourites is what we do is we get a class, this is a class, to sit in a semicircle, and we ask them to talk about their hopes and fears and expectations of relationships, and then we bring old people in. And we sit a couple in front of them, be any age, a married couple, and we say, guys, you can ask this couple anything you like at all about their relationship. It's slightly awkward, because they're like, they're older than my parents. But I love it, because we get 15-year-olds who, for the only time in their lives, can say to an adult who's not their mum and dad, I don't understand. Yeah, what happens when you argue? Or tell me about this, or sex, or whatever. And you do have the lad in the class that wants to say the most shocking thing about sex, or, yeah, what's your favourite position, or something. And then these couples will answer, and the 15-year-old goes, ugh! But what's amazing is, because the lads all ask about sex, but when we do the feedback forms afterwards, what everybody writes about is, I never knew that you could stay with somebody for such a long time. I never knew that you could argue and sort things out. I never knew that relationships could look like this. We have one couple who come in and do this thing, and they're really old. You know, they're in their 60s. And they look like this kind of very prim and proper Christian couple. And what I say to the guys is just probe and ask more questions. There's nothing too kind of probing to ask. And if there's something they say, kind of chase it, find out more. And this couple look really dull, and when they start talking, you know, his hobby is woodwork. They're not going to kind of light the world up as, oh, wow, you're an incredible couple with a story. But then the story unfolds that she was brought up in a children's home because her dad was an alcoholic and her mum had died. And she was in a children's home, and in those days, when you got to 17, they would give you a suitcase with one of everything you need, and they'd send you away. And you had to just go and find your way in the world at 17. And she had no idea what to do or where to go. And in the end, she thought, well, my brother lives up country. I'll go and see if I can live with him. And she went and lived with her brother for a time. He was a bit older. And I think she lived with him for about a year. And then he was moving away. And she kind of built a bit of a sense of wanting to stay where she was. And a family from the church took her in. And then the dad began to show her more interest than he should have done. And the dad of the family, the husband, began to do things to her he shouldn't. This girl had grown up in a children's home, not only knowing her parents. She was then interfered with by this guy. She then ended up very broken and very scared of relationships, but she ended up going out with this guy, Peter. She was too scared to go into a relationship with him. In the end, they kind of had to be encouraged that it was okay. The church kind of said, it's okay. And they started going out and they got married. And then all her life, really, she had looked at dads and daughters and just yearned for a kind of a dad who'd take an interest in her, who would show her love. And she says, with hindsight, she got really confused. And she was just desperate for dad attention. And she ended up having a relationship, although she's married and had kids now, with a bloke who was a lot older. And at the time, she didn't work out what was wrong with it or what kind of motivated things. And that relationship went on for 2 years until her husband found them in bed together. And husband found them. They had 3 young kids, and somehow they managed to work it through. And the husband didn't abandon her, and they worked through the affair, and they were this couple sat 30 years later in front of this bunch of youth. And for me, I love that couple talking to young people, because for me, she illustrates that everything that could go wrong in your life, you could have the worst of upbringings without parents, you can have terrible stuff happen to you, you can make wrong choices, and yet there's hope. And that's the story of the Bible. There's no point in the Bible, really, where it's like Donkey and Shrek, where God goes, who shall I use? And they're going, pick me, I'll be great, I'll be amazing. God always chooses the others. God doesn't choose donkeys who are there like, yes, me, I'm amazing. Well, apart from maybe a little bit of Saul, King Saul, because he was tall and handsome and the rest of it, but that went badly wrong. He always picks the people like Moses who go, you can't use me. Look, I screwed it up so badly. You know, don't you remember? I had the best upbringing. I brought up in a palace. You saved me from dying. Wow. And then the first time I kind of tried to be a leader, I kind of messed up because I killed someone by accident. And God goes, but I want you to lead the people. He goes, you just really can't use me. Please don't use me, God, please. I don't even know your name. And God goes, okay, my name's I Am. He goes, that doesn't help, God. And God, he goes, I can't, anyway, I can't talk. I'm rubbish at speaking, although I've been talking at you quite a long time, God. And God goes, that's all right. I made your lips. I could probably work around it. And Moses goes, no, useless. And he goes, okay, we'll use Aaron to talk if you really can't talk. And then Moses has Aaron come and help him, although Moses does do a lot of talking later. Do you know, it's interesting. Some people say, I can't speak. I can't stand up in front of people. Do you know how many Hollywood actors and actresses have a speech impediment? Yeah, Ed Sheeran, you know, obviously the greatest modern-day musician, actually had a speech impediment. He got over it by rapping to Eminem. His parents didn't know how bad the lyrics were because they were so fast. The guy who was vice president with Barack Obama, he had a speech impediment. But when in speaking, in standing up, it helped him with it. You may think, well, I can't do anything because I'm not very good at this. But actually, it doesn't preclude you. God doesn't say, are you good enough? When he goes to Moses and calls Moses, and Moses says, why are you choosing me? God doesn't go, well, your CV's quite good. You did well in your GCSEs in the Egyptian palace. He goes, Moses, I am. I'll be with you. Moses, actually, it's not really very important what you're good at or how well you are. The important thing is I'm calling you and I'll go with you. It doesn't matter how broken and messed up you are. It doesn't matter what your family story is. It doesn't matter whether you struggle with anxiety. It doesn't matter whether you are the least popular person in your class. It doesn't matter what you feel about yourself. God says, I choose you. I love you. I will be with you. Just to end, one of my favorite, in looking at losers in the Bible, one of my favorite people I've kind of come across is Philip, one of the apostles. Philip's rubbish. Not to put it too bluntly. Jesus says to Philip, we've got loads of people here. They need feeding. What are we going to do about it? How are we going to feed them? And Philip goes, well, I think basically I've done a little bit of maths, Jesus. And it's going to take, well, half a year's wages. So we're stuffed, Jesus. And Jesus goes, I wasn't asking you a maths question. We do theology here. Proper subject. And Philip's there going, oh, I don't know, Jesus, what are we going to do? And Andrew has to come up to go, Philip, look, mate, I've got a bloke, a kid, he's got 5 loaves, 2 fishes. Fob Jesus off with that, because you're out of your depth with maths. And then Jesus feeds 5,000 people. Another time, some Greeks come up to Jesus, some foreigners, to Philip, and they go, can we see Jesus? And Philip goes, oh, no, I don't know. What's the protocol? What's the rules? Are Greeks allowed to see Jesus? Do we like Greeks? And he's there going, I don't know what to do. Oh, nightmare. And Andrew comes over and goes, what's going on, Philip? And it says, he says, Greeks, do we send them to Jesus? And Andrew goes, come on, just take them to Jesus. That'd be the simplest thing. Another point, Jesus says, if you know me, you know the Father. If you've met me, you've met the Father. Jesus is talking all about it. And Philip goes, got a question? Well, if you showed us the Father, if we knew who the Father was, we'd be there. And Jesus goes, have you not been listening, Philip? I've just said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. It's that way round. Philip asked the rubbish question. Philip didn't get many GCSEs. But Jesus chose him to be one of 12. Because God, Jesus isn't going, oh, brilliant, A stars, you're in. Oh, dear, didn't do so well in GCSEs. You're no good, are you? God doesn't look at you like that. He doesn't go, that's not what I'm after, he goes. Do you know the best bit of Philip? Philip meets Jesus the first time, and he's got a mate called whatever his mate's called. And he goes to him, and he goes, yeah, Nathaniel. He goes, Nathaniel, mate, I found Jesus. And he goes, he's from Nazareth. And he goes, oh dear, no, you haven't been reading your Bible. Good things don't come from Nazareth. And rather than Philip going, well, okay, I'm out of my depth, we're going intellectual here, he goes, tell you what, mate, come and see Jesus. Any of us can do that. We don't need to argue with people in your class that go, does God really exist? I don't understand about suffering. We don't have to go, oh, well, you know, I've read a book on this, but I didn't understand it. We can just go, do you know what? I've met Jesus. Come and see. I don't understand anything about Jesus, but I'm a Christian. Can I pray for you? Jesus doesn't look at you and go, you've messed up. I know what you were doing last night. I've seen you. I've seen what you worry about. And so, Jesus doesn't go, you're out. He doesn't go, you had that happen to you when you were seven. You haven't got a hope. He goes, I love you. I know you. Come. None of us are beyond hope. You believe lies about yourself that make you not in the equation, that make you think you're not good enough. And Jesus goes, the truth is, none of that matters. What matters is you and me. You can be as outrageous as Judah. I'm not recommending trying it, but you can be as outrageous as Judah. You cannot get it. You cannot be doing well at school like Philip. And Jesus goes, none of that matters. What matters is, are you interested in me? Are you willing to come and know me? We need to stop, but we're just going to pray. Let's take a moment quiet.